Scott, and this is the all-new All Ball, man. All hoop, all the time, and all stories, all the time. We have, if you're just downloading this one, because my guest in this, and we're going to do a two-part deal with Andrew Bogut. If this is your first time downloading it, thank you so much. I hope you enjoy it. If you do, if you don't, doesn't matter. Write a review. I'm told it benefits me financially more than anything. Like, I like feedback. Also, you can tweet at me at Gottlieb Show. And Doug Gottlieb Show on Facebook as well. You can like it. I'll put it out there. We're going to blast this thing out. There are some great pods that we have done. And Scott Brooks is a two-part one. It's amazing. Jay Billis is a two-part one. It's amazing. I've been kind of blown away. Max Hooper's story, going back to last week. There's so many. Tremaine Davis. You haven't heard the Tremaine Davis one. Wow. Tremaine Davis was the honorary captain of the Super Bowl this year. And here's a kid who was in special ed until his senior year in high school, because he was awarded the state at three. His parents were addicts. His grandma adopted him. Turns out he wasn't special needs at all. He did have a learning disability and graduated San Diego State, helped turn that program around, and now is an educator and somebody who helps get resources to kids like him who didn't previously have them. He grew up in the Bay Area. So that's Tremaine Davis. Again, I am pimping my own work, but I have a philosophy on this, and it comes from my time when I was at ESPN, which people were always critical of ESPN for promoting other ESPN stuff. But here's a thought. If you're not promoting yourself, how can you expect anyone else to, right? It's the same idea of confidence. If you don't believe in yourself, how can you expect anyone else to believe in yourself? I do want to give you one quick thought on college basketball. And look, I have a personal goal to have on every coach who is going to coach in the NCAA tournament. I don't know if I'll get there. There's a couple of coaches who I'm on their shit list. So I don't know. Plus, like, it's a lot. But we're reaching out to all of them. If they qualify, we're getting them on. And some teams that don't qualify, we're going to get them on as well. So I think all of these things are great. But more than anything, this pod is designed occasionally to talk about current events and current stuff, but also to basketball, like all these sports, like, it's this big dysfunctional family. And when you see people or hear people, I want you to know what they're about. And I share my own stories within it. And because a lot of these people, some of them I'm friends with, some of them I'm friendly with, but we all kind of know it's the 6 degrees, it's like 1 degree of separation. Andrew Bogut's a perfect example. So, and I'll get to kind of some thoughts on the moment in a second. Andrew Bogut was the number one pick in the NBA draft in 2005. In 2005, I just started working for ESPN. I covered the draft on radio since 2002, and actually, 2003. So it was my third year. I was in New York City, and I was close with Ray Giacoletti and that Gonzaga crew. And of course, he had come over from Cheney and coaching Eastern Washington. And so he invited me to hang out with them after the draft. And we ended up, God, I'm going to have to look and find out what the late, like, bar, restaurant or something was, dive at like 3 a.m. And I remember hanging out with Andrew Bogut, like, there's no, and a lot of guys are this way. When they get drafted, they're still just kids and they're wide-eyed and the nicest human beings on earth. And then all of a sudden, you know, you give them $100 million and some of them become assholes. It does happen. But Bogues was different, man. He was always what the saying in college basketball is, an OKG, our kind of guy. Like, Bogey's everybody's kind of guy, you know, he just is. And part of it is that's how Aussies are. I mean, I have this thing where I've been around so much. I've talked to so many different people from so many different parts of the country, the world. Aussies are our type of people, man. They're like, they're just straight up, no bullshit. They're honest salesmen. They're flawed, but their flaw is that they're just honest. They just say what they think and they don't actually care. And they don't carry negative bias into anything that they're talking about, I just feel like. So maybe that's all the Aussies that I've come across, but I always think of these blokes as just the best. And I have people that have played in Australia, and those guys that have played in Australia all say the exact same thing, that they're just the best. Like, dude, if you could hang out with one group of people every day for the rest of your life and be Aussies, because they just have a much chiller, cooler way of looking at the world than the rest of us. The quick thought on, there's a bunch of stuff on college basketball. I got to get Justin Bean on here. I love this kid. Have you seen Utah State play? So Justin Bean he's originally from Oklahoma. His dad played at Idaho State. I mean, the NCAA tournament. And I can't wait to tell his story on this pod, or let him tell his story on this pod. It's pretty crazy. But I'm like a total buyer into this Utah State team as not just a team that should make the NCAA tournament, but one that could win a couple of games in the NCAA tournament. And this is after losing Sam Merrill, who's arguably their greatest player ever, right? Which is crazy. The big kid, Nnamdi Keita, he'll be a star in the NBA, but he'll definitely play in the NBA as he's not huge. He's probably only 6'9", but long arms, big hands, becoming a decent offensive player, but can block shots without fouling, can roll and finish, got really good hands, huge, big, good hands catching and finishing. They don't really play that much roll and replace ball or roll and throw it to the rim, but he obviously can. But it's more, you know, they have a freshman point guard, Raleigh Worcester, who's from Missoula, Montana. Dude's a stud. But they have this kid, Justin Bean, who has been there forever, and they're going to always be there forever because this year doesn't count. And I mean, when you've played basketball, you've coached basketball, you've analyzed basketball, you realize there are guys that, and he scores, but there are guys that don't score a point, but they dramatically affect winning. And that's Justin Bean. I'm a buyer in Utah State. I like these Mountain West teams. I've covered a lot. I just think, the more I watch, the more I realize that some of these West Coast teams, West Coast always feels like it's a little bit underrated, undervalued, right? It's always the East Coast bias. But I do think that this year it's more of a real thing. And the real thing comes from this. The real thing comes from this year, especially, a lot of those teams couldn't travel. A lot of them couldn't practice early on. But we don't realize that I'm going to see USC tomorrow night. Against Stanford, like they each have a first round draft pick on their team, right? A top 10 draft pick on their team. I'm watching Oklahoma State, and you start to realize that the difference between Oklahoma and Oklahoma State is one team has the number one pick in the draft and the other one's Oklahoma, right? And that those guys at this time of year become guys that can just take over games and can win you a game. That's always been the case. And so if you have a pro to go along with a good team, I think it makes you a better team, especially if you're playing together, than some of these other schools. Like, some of these ACC schools do not have pros. They just don't. The mid-majors there's a distinct drop-off in terms of talent in the mid-majors now. And I'm talking about the Missouri Valley. I'm talking about the OVC. I'm talking about, and I'm not trying to be a jerk about it, but I'm just pointing out that players transferring up, like as good as Drake is and has been, Darren's done amazing job. One, he's lost his top two players to injury for the year. Right, but they're going to get the benefit of all the wins they had earlier. And two, you know, his one NBA player is a center who transferred to Minnesota. Like, guys are transferring up now. And I point it out because those teams don't have pros, and you will see it on the floor in the NCAA tournament. The team that has the pro at the end of the game is probably going to win the game because they're all teams are marginally different than one another. Anyway, I look, Boise has a pro in Derek Alston. Utah State has a pro in Nnamdi Keita. And I think obviously USC has one. I look around college basketball and I start to say, and I think maybe the most underrated team, undervalued team is going to be Oregon. Like, Oregon's the type of team that is going to get some 8 or 9 seed because they've had these weird losses, right? They didn't have their top three players and lost to Oregon State, for example. And you're going to go like, how good is Oregon really? Then you see them play like, holy crap, they got players. So I think there's more East Coast bias this year. It's not because I live on the West Coast and broadcast. I've also done Big Ten games. And I think that conference is really good, but a lot of it is they had a high recidivist rate. They have older players. And the reason that the Illinois, for example, will close better and be better in the tournament is, well, they have Ayo Dosunmu, who's going to be a pro, right? I don't know about Kofi Coburn. Like, he'll play in the NBA, but what's his role? It's hard because he just doesn't move out in the floor all that well, but he is a monster. Whereas, you know, like in Iowa, I think Wieskamp is an NBA player. And I think Garza makes the NBA, but it's a hard Like, who does he guard? Anyway, that's my just 1 minute kind of tangential rant on West Coast basketball. I think the Mountain West should get three teams in. Personally, I love this Colorado State team. They feel like the hardest fit. But Colorado State, Utah State, San Diego State, Boise State, all really good clubs. And San Diego State's going to get in by way of sweeping Boise. Boise should get in. But they swept Utah State, but Utah State, they didn't play them at Utah State, and they didn't have Raleigh Worcester. And I think Utah State should get in. And, you know, like I kind of think Colorado State's really good as well. But if they get left by the wayside, it's going to suck. But I've watched a bunch. I've seen all the leagues. And I can tell you that the ACC, the idea of getting seven or eight teams in is kind of laughable considering how everyone in that league knows how down that league actually is. Yet this time of year, everybody kind of solidarity for our league. Let's get a bunch of teams in. One other thought, like I think I'm as impressed by Cade Cunningham not scoring a ton as I did have him having 40 points on Saturday, right? On Monday, the entire focus was two on the ball, make him get the ball out of his hands. And what separates Cade Cunningham from so many of these other one and dones is one, I think he's completely locked in on winning the game. Sometimes he's tried to do it by himself and it hasn't worked out great, but he is so ultra competitive. And the type of leader he is at 19 years old is remarkable. Like, I'm going to give you feedback because I will have seen almost all these top 10 kids play. I'm going to see Mobley tomorrow night. But I'm just blown away by the way that kid handles himself, the competitiveness. He guarded every position 1 through 5 last night. He played every position 1 through 5. And even though his offense was limited at times, he had a couple big buckets down the stretch, and he willingly got rid of the ball when he was double teamed. I mean, there's a special makeup in Cade Cunningham. All right, let's get to the pod. Andrew Bogut was the number one pick in the NBA draft, but his upbringing, what led him to be, I'm going to warn you here. Okay. I do obviously curse on this podcast a little bit, and if it makes you uncomfortable, I apologize. I try and make this thing as real and organic as possible. Andrew and I talked an hour and a half, and there's still about one, some hijinks at Australian Institute of Sport. There's some Majera stories in here. There's some NBA stories in here. It's really good. You'll really enjoy it. I just want to warn you, like, if you're a, hey, I'm going to play it, and there's kids in the car, there's some words and language which I wouldn't want to be playing when my kids are in the car. I just wouldn't. It's above and beyond the usual S-bombs, whatever, you know, but it's some language stuff. So I'm only warning you because I don't want to edit it. I don't want to take away from the stories themselves. And I do think in this particular case, they do fit. It's just not dudes cursing in the dark just to sound cool. But I want to make sure I point that out. All right. Without further ado, here's a longtime NBA center, now retired, we think, although teams continue to call him, from Australia, the man himself, Andrew Bogut.
Fox Sports Radio has the best sports talk lineup in the nation. Catch all of our shows at foxsportsradio.com. And within the iHeartRadio app, search FSR to listen live.
Okay, so there's a lot to you, right? There's a lot. So I want to start at the very beginning part, okay? Where in Australia were you born?
I was born in the city of Melbourne, Australia, in a small suburb called Mulgrave Hospital. So grew up out in the outer suburbs, probably about almost an hour from the city.
Okay, so what, like, apartment, house? Again, like, we all have, you just have to understand, 99% of Americans haven't been to Australia. Of that 1% that have been there, they probably went to Sydney, maybe they visit Melbourne, you know, maybe they visit, but in terms of the idea of how you were raised, house, apartment, condo, big lot, what was it?
Yeah, we were kind of, I guess, the lower income areas growing up for the most part, in a house, but kind of, you know, in the areas that were definitely not on anyone's bucket list by any means. And then we kind of moved to the next suburb over, which was a new housing estate, still kind of near the bad suburbs, but was a new estate. And then that's kind of where I spent most of my childhood. So we were fortunate enough to have a you know, 4-bedroom house, but I wouldn't say it was in an area that you'd aspire to try and get to one day.
Right, right. It's like everybody tries to almost brag how poor it was, but you didn't grow up broke, but you didn't. It wasn't like you grew up, you know, in living in fantasy land. What is that? What is Melbourne known for? What is that suburb known for? It's like, if you're an Aussie and you come to that area, what's it known for?
Well, where I grew up was a working class area. So it was mainly people that were laborers, worked in warehouses, factories, ran their, maybe their own small business. I mean, my father was a mechanic. So we had, you know, we had good years and bad years economically. Like we had a recession throughout that where we were, you know, kind of poor for a couple of years and then back to middle class and then back down. Just that battle of a, you know, family of four. The city of Melbourne's probably best known for, I would say, food and coffee is kind of the, what it's known for. Coffee, we're kind of coffee snobs down here, so we know a good coffee when we have it. So that's why I struggled a little bit in America with finding good coffee. But yeah, food culture.
Even in San Francisco, you like the coffee?
It was okay. It was better than Oklahoma or, you know, somewhere in the middle of the US where you kind of could only find a Starbucks. But yeah, we're a bit, you know, we're self-proclaimed coffee snobs. So yeah, we can definitely know a good brew. So I struggled at times to find a good coffee over there. I found a few places that I could get good beans, but yeah, it's just a battle that we have to go through when we leave Melbourne.
Okay. So when your coffee, Andrew Bogut's like dream coffee. You make it's like black, or do you have a specific coffee drink? Is it an espresso based drink? Like, what type of coffee snob are you?
I mix it up. So right now, I've gone through phases of straight espresso in the morning. I've gone through phases of macchiatos. I've gone through phases of right now. I'm back on lattes. Usually during the day when I'm in a warmer climate, I have an iced coffee. So just coffee and milk with ice. So I mix it up. I try to be multidimensional.
Okay, so your latte now of choice. How many shots in it?
Shots of coffee? Yeah. Just one. I just go one shot of coffee. I have two coffees a day, one when I wake up and one after lunch.
No, but I mean, like, if you have a latte is a shot of espresso or two shots of espresso and then milk, and then if you want flavoring in it. Okay, so then, like, are you doing, do you do, like, 2%? Do you do skim? Do you do almond? Do you do oat milk?
Full cream, baby. None of that soy shit. No. Full cream. No sugars anymore. I'm off sugar. So I've been off sugar for a number of years. I'm not completely off it. Like, I'll have it, you know, if it happens to be a piece of chocolate or whatever, but I just don't add coffee. I don't add sugar to my coffee anymore. I used to be the opposite. I couldn't have coffee without a sugar because it was too bitter. But now I've kind of appreciated
taste.
Yeah, that taste of just coffee without any sweetness to it.
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, we used to have, when I played at Oklahoma State, we used to have some coffee before the game. We started that because we had these 11 a.m. games for whatever reason on Saturdays. And so me and one of my teammates, we started drinking coffee. And then when I was working at ESPN, it was cold. It was the first time I'd lived like in a really – well, I guess in Russia, they had chai. Hoyche chai? One chai? So you just pound chais to stay warm, right? And sometimes espresso-based drinks as well, some cappuccino and whatever. But when I first started with the Starbucks thing, I started with like caramel macchiatos. I was like, man, this is great. And then you realize how much sugar's in them. You're like, oh. So then I dialed it back and like slowly weaned off kind of the sugar stuff. Next time you're stateside, you got to try Phil's. You like real cream, real coffee, and real sugar?
Phil's. Where's that at? In the city?
They have it. It's based in San Francisco, but they have it in LA. They have a couple in New York, I think. It's like a small growing brand. It's pretty good. I mean, I go on, I'm like you, I change drinks a lot and I change my coffee thing, but I'm a coffee snob, so I love
it. Nothing like
it. Without any question. That's basically why I'm going to have as many Aussies on as possible. But I thought all your guys' thing was like, let's go play some ball and then let's go get pissed. Let's go drink beer. Like, so is coffee ahead of beer in Melbourne?
For the working people, it probably is. Yeah, I mean, it's hard to have some beers and get to work and be motivated. But yeah, I mean, we definitely like to have a few drinks at the end of the day. There's no doubt about that.
So, your dad's a mechanic. What kind of mechanic? What did he fix?
He was a carburetor and fuel injection specialist. So he would basically the equivalent of like a Jiffy Lube chain or whatever, and all these other mechanics. They would know how to fix a carburetor generally, because it's kind of a specialist type job. So they would get the carburetor off. My mum would go drive out to, you know, Jiffy Lube down the streets, cold. She'd go drive down, pick it up, bring it back to my dad, and he'd fully recondition and sometimes strip it down to the base and clean it all up, paint it, make it look good, brand new. Mum drives it back, they fit it, and the customer's got a brand new carburetor. So that was kind of what my dad did, and kind of a dying trade to an extent now with fuel injection and obviously battery, you know, operated cars. But a lot of drag races, a lot of people that have hotted up cars still need carburetors on them to function. So he still does it just kind of part-time for fun. But yeah, that was kind of the way we made a living.
Did he have his own like hot rod, like under the, like that he always worked on at the house?
He always had something. Yeah, he always had something. So that's kind of where my passion from cars came from, because I used to have to go to the workshop with him a lot, especially on school holidays. You know, we couldn't afford a babysitter or have me stay at home all day. So I'd have to just get dragged along with my mum or dad, and my dad was a babysitter as he worked. So, yeah, I just remember always him working on customers' hotted up cars, and then he'd have a few every couple of years. He'd have a different one. So that was kind of where my passion for it all kind of came together.
So when did your passion for basketball start?
For me, I always, it's a hard one. I love sport as a young fella. So like 4, 5, 6, 7, always ball sports, you know, football, tennis, soccer, basketball. And then the seriousness for basketball kind of started probably at about 9 or 10, where once it became organized and the enjoyment I got out of it, it was like, all right, this is what I want to do. I really enjoy it. Didn't really think about being a professional at that. You know, no one really at 9 or 10 years old is thinking about that. I just love playing the game. Watched it on TV whenever I could, was just immersed in it fully, was kind of all in, and just kind of grew from there. And as I went through the ranks of high school and whatnot, started to get better and enjoy it more, and never really thought about anything else, to be honest with you.
Now, you were maybe part of that first generation, and forgive me if I'm wrong, okay, but I remember you as one of the first generation of the AIS guys, the Australian Institute of Sport, right? And Delly obviously was a little bit later on. I remember when I first heard about Delly's name, like, man, we played against this. AIS guys came and toured, and we played against this point guard. It's going to be unbelievable. And I remember the first time I met him. And so there's this lineage of guys. When did you first go to AIS?
My first year was 2002, so I got a scholarship to go in 2002, and then went for half a year in 2003, and then, you know, in August was at the University of Utah. So I guess before me, you know, there were some big names. Luke Longley came through that program, so there were. But then I guess once I'd come through, that snowball effect started of Dellavedova and Joe Ingles and Patty Mills and Aaron Baines, and the list goes on, right? And now most of the NBA players from Australia have had some sort of affiliation to the AIS at some point in their career.
How did they find out about you? How did you get the scholarship there? What's the actual process like?
Well, I was really lucky because in Australia, it's a whole different system to America. We don't really play for our high school, so our competitive basketball is done on the weekends. Kind of, you play for your local kind of league, and then if you're really good in that suburb or area, you then represent that whole suburb against other suburbs on a Friday night, which is called rep basketball, representative basketball, which is kind of the equivalent to AAU. And then if you're really, really good, starting from under 16, you represent your whole state at the national championships. So, you know, there's 7 or 8 teams that go to those national championships, sometimes a team from New Zealand as well. And that's where you generally get scouted for the AIS. The issue for me was I never made those teams. I never made those state teams. I was always cut under 16s. I didn't get an invite. Under 18s, I got an invite and I got emergency. So if someone got hurt, I got to go, which was kind of a blessing in disguise because it motivated me more. I still got to train with those guys. And then by the end of it, by the time they took off to go, no one got hurt, obviously. I was kicking all their asses, but I was the emergency, so I couldn't go. And then the AIS would go to the national championships because, you know, logic says if you're going to see the best players, you go to the national championships to scout. Well, I wasn't there. So I thought, well, I'm not going to get a chance for the AIS or the Australian junior national team camps. And then I was playing so well here locally that they just got a whiff of my name and just kind of gave me like a wild card invite. Last minute, the camp was in September. I got the letter in like August to go up for the camp. And then I went up there and no one really knew who I was. And that was kind of a good thing because I came and all these kids that have been in that national championships and that program for a number of years, all kind of knew each other. You knew who the household names were from each state. People were like, who the hell is this dude? Like, skinny, wiry dude. And I came in the first day of camp, kicked everyone's ass. And then they offered me a scholarship on the first day. At the end of the day, they brought me in and said, we want to bring you in. And like, that was a huge emotional moment for me because I was kind of always overlooked and felt like I never really got a really good chance to be part of teams and to get a scholarship somewhere where I could essentially have my bedroom next to a basketball gym was paradise for me.
What were your parents like in terms of you obviously at some point loved basketball and your dad's a mechanic and your mom's helping him out. And here you are saying, I love basketball. And no matter how good you thought you were and overlooked you were, a lot of people are like, oh, you're just emergency on the state team, right? You're not. What were they like in terms of their support of you?
Oh, they're real supportive. I mean, look, with basketball, especially in Australia, like if your parents aren't supportive, you're not getting to the games because it's a lot of driving. It's a lot of time in cars. I mean, most parents that deal with junior sports, like I said, America's a little bit different because high school takes care of a lot of it. Here's much harder. Your parents really have to drive you everywhere and you've got your training sessions every day. And so without them, you wouldn't be getting from point A to point B to even get there. Dad, you know, modified the backyard at one point to put a basketball hoop in. I had a basketball hoop at his workshop as well. So he always told people I was going to be a professional. And you don't know really if he thought that because people don't know if he thought that just because he was my dad. It was just biased, but he knew how much time I spent out in the backyard. So he saw firsthand how much I love the game. And it got so bad that I'd be outside shooting in the rain, playing basketball in the rain. And then he actually put some floodlights up for me near the basketball court so I could actually shoot once it got dark. Because in Melbourne, winter, it gets dark at about 5 p.m. at night. Like, you know, so I'd be out there till 9:30. Like, neighbors would be losing their shit, hating me because the ball was bouncing. And I'd just be out there shooting until my mum came and yelled at me to come back inside. And so he kind of knew, like, he saw how much I was invested in it. And that's all I thought about. And I think he always told people I was going to be a professional. And most other parents or friends would be like, yeah, yeah, whatever. Like, this, you know, you're crazy. Every parent says that about their kid. But he was one of those people that was kind of really confident, probably more confident than I was at that point, you know.
Do you remember calling them and telling them about the scholarship to AIS?
Oh, definitely. Yeah, emotional moment. Like I said, yeah, just with the journey that I went through, my whole journey wasn't smooth sailing. So that's what was cool about finally having that opportunity to be somewhere that's special. You know, there's only 12 kids a year that get that opportunity in the whole of Australia. And then you're basically on that pathway to be as good as you want to be, essentially, whether you go to college, the NBL, the NBA, you're in kind of the box seat. But the flip side of the AIS is there's a lot of kids that think they've made it once they've made the AIS. So that's what I was always cognizant of. Like, make sure you use this opportunity to get even better. Don't just think like, oh shit, I'm here now. I'm top 12 in Australia. You know,
yeah, but where does that come from though? But where does that come from? Because like, look, that's really natural, right? For guys that think they made it, yet you're telling yourself these things like to continue to motivate yourself. Is that your dad? Is that just your internal instinct of how you've always been? How, like, you're what, 17 at the time? You're 17,
yeah,
you finally
16, big 17,
first opportunity,
yeah.
Right? Great honor. Most dudes are like, I made it. You're not. Where does that come from?
Well, I never had it. I never had it as a junior. So, like I said, I never got invited. I was never in the cool group as a basketball junior. Like, I was never in the good teams. I bounced around to two different teams throughout my junior childhood, you know.
What were the teams called?
So I started with the Dandenong Rangers, which was my local club. They were a big, big stadium now. I think they've got something like 16 courts now in their gym, or 14 or 16 courts. So I was there for two or three years and then got put in like the third team. So A, B, C, I got put in the C team, and this is some bullshit. So I left and then went to Waverley Falcons for a season and a half and then finished off at Sandringham. And I talk about it on my podcast. I do my journey episodes where we go through all this. And that Sandringham team was kind of a team of misfits, a team of, I guess, kids that were just shunned by society. And it was the perfect fit for me. I was like, this is me. Like, this is my group. Parents of other teams hated us. Other teams hated us. We were one of the teams that had hardly any parents showing up to watch their own kids. It was one of those teams, right? So, like, I was like, this is me. This fits in perfectly. But, yeah, back to your question, it was just like I always was afraid of losing the opportunity because I never had it. So I was like, once I got it, I was like, I don't want to fuck this up.
Yeah. Is that Waverly team? Is that where you developed your ability to screen legally? Is that where? Like...
that was Rick Majerus, funnily enough, at Utah. Yeah. He used to, he was big on screening. If you didn't make contact on a screen, man, oh, you were running for the rest of that session. So I learned real early that if I set a screen, you better clap bodies. Otherwise you're going to hear it from Rick.
Was there any, who else was up? Okay. So you're at AIS. Do you have one roommate? You guys all, is it one big dorm room? Like, what is it?
It's basically one kind of narrow building that has a spiral staircase through the middle. And on each landing, there's three rooms and everyone has their own little room, but the rooms weren't luxurious by any means. You basically walk into your room, you've got a skinny little bed. It's kind of like a balance beam in gymnastics. So you don't want to turn too much or you're falling out of that thing. You got a small little study desk, you got a little heater and a little sink and a wardrobe, and that's it. The bathrooms are then shared on each level. There's one bathroom on each level. So basically all 12 of us are in one kind of tall four level building essentially that's all wide open. And it was cool. Like, you're just 16, 17 years old. You're away from home. You're living with your boys and, you know, having fun, bantering, getting in fights, doing stupid shit. Like, that's part of the fun of going through that journey. And to be honest with you, like, that was probably one of the most enjoyable phases of my career, was just going through all that and all the dumb shit that we did and got in trouble. And, you know, we were 16, 17, and then girls came into play and all that kind of stuff. So it was a fun part of my life that I really, really enjoyed.
Okay, give me the stupidest shit that you mean. I'll share a stupid shit story, and then you can share a stupid shit story. Okay, so I grew up going to a basketball camp called Snow Valley Basketball Camp. It's at Westmont College. Westmont is if there's a more affluent part of Santa Barbara, that's exactly what it is. Right? I mean, it's unbelievable. It's right near where Oprah lives, right? So, but this camp it's like the best fundamental camp around. You don't even have a basketball the first day and a half. So we used to go up there with a bunch of our buddies, and I would do both sessions. And I have a buddy named Adam Libby. And Adam was, it was like four dudes in a room, you know, bunk beds. And so I'll never forget that you could pull out the middle slats that held up the top bunk, and it would still stay up. And then somebody hop on the top bunk and they'd fall down to the bottom bunk. So, and then we do the icy hot in the jock strap and the undershorts of jock strap.
Yeah, we do that. Yeah,
So, but on one particular night, like, he got out of the shower and put on some underwear that we had put Icy Hot in. And then I had also pulled out the slat. So it was like a double whammy at once. And the camp director comes in, and everybody's got, like, it's like bed check. So the camp director comes in to check on us. He just put on these underwear and he hops in the top bunk, falls through onto the bottom bunk, right? Now dudes are laughing and he's mad, he's pissed. Then he stands up and now his balls are on fire. And he's going to kick me out of the camp. I'm like 12 and 13 at the time. All right, so just give me one hijinks, Andrew Bogut, Australian Institute of Sport.
Oh, we had a lot, like, similar stories to those, right? We have, this is a pretty disgusting one, but.
That's okay.
So, yeah. At the AIS, I told this one on my own pod as well, but at the AIS, when you're under 18, you can't, you basically have to sign out whenever you leave the campus, campus-like atmosphere when you're under 18. When you're under 18, you can't really go out and party because you got to be back at 12:30 on a Saturday, and I think it was 10 o'clock on a weeknight. So the underage guys like myself, we couldn't really go party with the older guys. So the 18-year-olds we had on the team, they could go party, drink, go to clubs, whatever, right? So they go out one night, and they come back at like, 3 or 4 in the morning, come back to our block, and they wake myself and a teammate of mine up who shall remain nameless. And we have these kind of network phones. You can call each other's rooms just on those regular wired old school phones that kids these days probably don't know about.
Yep.
And I call them and I say, man, this is some bullshit. They came back at 3 in the morning. They're working us up. They're making a shitload of noise. They went to the top level room and they're partying in there, continuing on the partying. So I'm like, we're going to do something. So I had a bunch of firecrackers, right? So I said, look, I'm going to light a few of these and throw them under the door. So I throw a few under the door while they're in the room. Goes off, bang, 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 nothing. They don't react. So there's a teammate of mine who I know who I ended up playing with later on who'd be like, oh, it's just Bogues. Ignore him. Ignore him. It's just, this will piss him off if we ignore him, right? Right. So I was pissed off. Dude, they ignored it. I got no pushback, which is what I wanted, right? So I'm like, man, what can we do? So in that block, like, everyone has their own room, and the doors, no one really locked them because we had a main door at the front. So you just, if you went to someone else's room, you'd leave your door wide open. So one of my teammates that I'm with, he goes, oh, I told you about the sinks, right? Because I'm gonna go shit in someone's sink. So I'm like, oh, yeah, do it. I'm gassing it up. Like, there's no way he's gonna do it. Like, it's 3 a.m. Like, how can you just shit on command? Like, do it, right? So he goes downstairs. And there was a teammate of ours, and his door's just wide open. And he was kind of more like, he had a bit of arrogance to him, but he was a quiet, kind of softer guy. He wasn't really a fighter. So his door's the one that happens to be open, right? And it's on the bottom floor. So my teammate goes down there, jumps up on his sink, squats down, and I just hear it drop on the sink. And I'm just like, no way. He's really done it, right? So I'm like, uh-oh, here we go. So he yells at me like, hey, go get me some toilet paper from the bathroom. So I'm like, all right. So I run up and get some toilet paper. I bring it back and give it to him. Wipes his ass, puts the papers in the guy's bin, leaves the shit in the sink. So then we go back to bed, right? So I can't sleep with this. I'm just sitting there in my bed, like, I'm just waiting there, just waiting like this, like, what's going to happen? So then we hear the door open from the top landing. So we're like, okay, they're eventually going to bed. So then you hear everyone go down to their room. You hear everyone's door shut. And the other guy's on the bottom, so he gets there last. About 3 minutes later, you just hear, what the fuck? Oh my God. Like, you know, just losing it. So then you just hear the click of everyone else's doors open up again. Like, what's going on? It was like this big thing. So another teammate comes to my room, knocks on my door. He's like, I know it was you. You would do some shit like that. Why'd you do that? He was like ready to fight me. Right. So I'm like, hey, if you want to fight, let's do it. So I'm just letting you know, I didn't do it. Like, I didn't rat my teammate out, but I'm just like, I didn't do it. It was not me. But if you want to fight, we can go. And it kind of calmed down. So the kid that got his sink shitted in, he picks up the shit with his, finds a stick, walks out into the common area, throws it into the wall, right? So now this thing's stuck onto a wall and kind of like, you know, dripped down the wall, right? So there's like just a shit streak on the wall. So then I guess in the morning, the coaches find out, the AIS finds out, they have to lock the block down, right? They have to call the local county or council. The dude came in a hazmat suit, like full hazmat, like with the backpack and the Ghostbusters spray. They had to close the block down. I think we got kicked out for, I think it was 8 to 10 hours. They had to like spray it all down, you know, because salmonella and like people can get sick. So we basically inadvertently kicked ourselves out of our block for 10 hours. And it was like a big deal. Like the kid, my teammate got suspended for a week. But that's just, it's disgusting and stupid, but it's like just dumb stuff.
Did they do contract tracing on the ship? That's how they found out.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah. They made us wear a mask for a couple of weeks. Yeah, but I mean, that's a disgusting one that some people will think is funny, some won't. But when you got a group of 16, 17 year old boys together, dumb shit ensues.
No question. Okay, so how'd you get to Utah?
Long story, but there was a coach named Ken Shields, who was a Canadian basketball legend. He had his fingerprints on Steve Nash back in the day, and he could come out to Australia and saw me and was friends with Majerus and was like, you gotta come out and recruit this guy. And they got on me early, recruited me very, very early, right when I got to the AIS, no one really knew about me. And then I just kind of stuck with them. And I was supposed to go over at the end of 2002, supposed to come over for Christmas and redshirt that Christmas till following year and then start my freshman year. And then I got screwed with some transcripts. The NCAA deemed me ineligible because I didn't have enough science credits. I did a class called Sports Studies in Australia. It was half social, half physical credits. And the NCAA, being the geniuses they are, said, well, it's either one or the other. It can't be social. It can't be, you know, physical. It can't be social. Can't be half-half. It's one or the other. So then whichever side I put those credits towards, I was short on the other side. So then I couldn't go over. Rick Majerus pretty much went nuts at that assistant that was recruiting me because he blamed him, sent him on like a year recruiting trip. I didn't see him. Once I got to Utah, I saw him one day. He was gone the whole year. He blamed him for it. But I eventually got over there the next year. And
was it Judson or was it Donnie Daniels?
No, it was a guy named Silvy Dominguez.
I know Silvy. Yeah, I know Silvy.
Yeah, sure. So he was...
And he's tiny. Like Sylvie's like 5'2", 5'3". Like you and Sylvie together had to be the most bizarre combo ever.
Well, I never met him. He was recruited from remotely, right? So he was kind of, it was him. Jeff Strom was involved as well, but then he moved on to, I believe, Marquette. And then Kerry Rupp. Kerry Rupp came on later, but they passed it on to Sylvie. And then he was involved with just my kind of communication, sending me the letters. They just gave it to him to do all the admin type stuff. And then when the transcripts didn't pass by NCAA, Rick just blamed him. And like I said, I saw the guy. Saw the guy, he came to one training session that whole freshman year of mine. Never saw him again. It's crazy.
What was your first year like under Rick?
It was real hard. I'm not going to lie. He was, you know, may rest in peace. I preface it that way. And he was one of the best basketball minds I've ever played for. He was a genius basketball-wise. Like 30-point scorers we're playing against will not score 30 against us. If they did, they'd shoot 20%. We would never be underprepared. He was unbelievable as far as that went. Spacing, execution, time and score, unbelievable. But he was a coach that would make you question how much you love the game every day. Every day. Not one minute you spent with him. You wouldn't question that. And I saw a lot of kids with a lot of talent quit completely, transfer, hate life, hate basketball, because it was a mental battle daily. He'd just be, you know, he was hard, very, 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 very hard. He wouldn't be able to coach today with the way things are going. It would only take one person to sit in there and record a training session with their phone and he'd be gone, you know, because he was very, very hard. And it kind of helped me get to where I am. But at the same time, it was a struggle. You know, I was homesick, didn't know a person when I got off a plane in Utah. And he was tough.
Did he, were you there? Did he take the dump on the floor? Was that when you were there?
Nah, that was, I think years before me, where he said, yeah, if you're going to play like shit, you'll train with shit. But I heard about that story. But he used to do so much crazy stuff.
Like, well, so here's the story I heard, and I won't tell you who I heard it from, but when he left, right? So I'll give you, he recruited me too when I transferred from Notre Dame to Oklahoma State. But Mark Jackson didn't play with you your first year, right? Mark was your point guard.
No, he quit. Yeah,
right. Majerus called him the C word, was the only name he would call him. He wouldn't call him Mark, right?
We called everyone the C word, but yeah, yep.
But Mark felt like that was, he wouldn't call him Mark and he wouldn't call him Jackson. He would just call him the four letter C word. Yeah. And so when Jack Aletti got the job, Mark came into his office and said, like, hey, coach, I'd like to play. He's like, should be allowed to have you. He's like, I got one, like, I have one, it's not a request, like, I just, one, basically one thing. He's like, what is it? He's like, well, you promised to never call me a cunt. And he was like, done. Why would I ever call you? He's like, because that's the only thing that Rick would call me.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, and Mark Jackson, what's crazy about it is Mark Jackson is the epitome of a Majerus player. That dude was tough as shit. Like, diving on loose balls, had a 3-point shot. New time and score, play, he'd do anything. You say, go run through that wall, he'd do it. And you're just like, dude, you're railing the one guy. It's like the epitome of what you coach for and what you want out of your players. But it was great to get him back. But yeah, like that was daily, man. He used that word a lot. It was all kinds of stuff, man. Like, go back to Australia. Like, he'd be, your high school coaches were idiots. Who the hell coached you? They're morons. Like, every day, man, you're just like, like, no let up at all. I speak about it I just did a Utah portion of my journey for my freshman year on the Rogue Bows podcast. And I still remember we had high school coaches come to watch our practice one time and he'd be cussing them out. Like, just watching our practice session and he'd be like, you know, excuse my language, I hope this isn't PG, but he'd be like, look at these cocksuckers up here watching my practice. They're writing down all my plays in their little notebooks. Defense and rebounding, that's what wins games. They don't know shit about execution. They don't know, and you're just like, these coaches are up there, guests. and they're just like, what do we do? what do we do? But that's how he was. He was just, you know, he'd be cussing out on the road. We'd have shoot arounds. God forbid a janitor came in the arena bowl. Like, that was up in the 50th row. He just somehow see him and just start lighting into him. Who is that motherfucker up there? Hey, what are you doing? You know, and you're just like, I'm the janitor. I'm just here to clean the, you know, leftover popcorn from last game and just laying into people. But
so the team that went to the Final Four, was that team? So yep. he was recruiting me. So this is 97. So spring of 97. Spring of 97.
Yeah.
So 96, 97. He's recruiting me. And I went to Notre Dame. I got in trouble after starting as a freshman. I sat out at a junior college in Southern California. And so he came and I would practice with the team, but not play. So I didn't lose a year. And he brought Jeff Judkins and I think Donnie Daniels. And I practiced for 2 hours and then we talked. And then everybody left, and then he closed the doors, and they worked me out for like another hour and a half, just me. So yeah, you can play. Like, let's go get some meat. So we go, and they're playing UC Irvine, and we go and eat. And he was like telling me about how he's on a diet, he's really trying to watch. Meanwhile, like I got like a burger and fries, and I look up, and he's like eating all my fries, and he's asking me about my burger. And so then he ordered the exact same burger I had. But what I remember about him is obviously I remember like how he treated people was crazy. But I also remember, like, there was a level of discipline that I had just never seen before, never, where he would say, like, again, Van Horn was on the team then, and Hanametal and those guys. He'd be like, Keith, two lines. And he'd go back to coaching, and fucking Keith Van Horn gets back behind the line, sprints down, and sprints back, and then gets back in the drill. You know, like, some coaches, you're like, hey, go give me a lap or go run the line, and guys are, yeah. You know, whatever, because they're mad. Like, there was none of that shit. So it's crazy that he was, you know, borderline abusive, but it did work. And there was an incredible level of discipline as a guy who, like, dude, look, you're a smart dude. You're a free thinker. You know, you'll fuck around with anybody. How did you handle the discipline nature? Obviously, taking that you're away from home and all that stuff, but how did you handle somebody demanding all of these things of you, which I just wondered how you personally handled that?
It was a battle at times. Like, it's just because it was every day. That was a thing. You knew the moment he walked in the gym to the moment he left, it was balls to the wall. And I think that's where, I think at times, maybe if just once a month he gave some positive reinforcement, you'd be like, ah, cool. Like, but that wasn't him. And the thing that shocked me most was, like, I still remember a session, like, probably I was in there for about a month or two and just railing into everyone. And one session, he was on me for like 3 hours straight and then tell me everything. Go back to Australia. Your coaches sucked, you know, blah, 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 blah. And then the moment the session ended, we walked off the court, literally 30 centimeters from the sideline. And it's like he was bipolar. Came up to me, put his arm around me. He said, hey, Bogut, you know, how are you? You need anything? Can I take you out to eat? You know, do you need any clothes? What do you, you know, you're just like, man, this guy was just railing me for 3 hours straight, like telling me I'm the worst recruit ever. He regrets recruiting me. And then that's just how he was. He would try to overdo the off-court stuff because he knew deep down, like he wasn't towing the line. He was way over the line at times. Right. He would try to fix that by going over the top off the court with making sure that you were good. And look, I think he had a good heart deep down, but he was just – he was an intense, crazy dude. And that's just, you know, I definitely got better under him. And he taught me so much about, especially the defensive end and time and score was a big one that he taught me about. Don't take that shot right now. We don't need that. Or, you know, I had no idea about that coming from Australia. So he was definitely had his imprint on kind of the way I played.
I'm trying to think who the player was. It's like David something or other. God dang it. And he might have been David Jackson, who transferred out of there. I mean, I know there's a lot of guys that transferred out of there. But so the Gonzaga guys, they told me, I think it was David Jackson. Look this up. Yes, David Jackson, Portland, Oregon. So David Jackson in 90s, he was there in 96, 97, 97, 98, and he played a little less than half the game. And he ended up transferring to Oregon. So the story goes, he visited Gonzaga. And those guys, the Gonzaga guys, they're like all of us, right? Like, they're smart asses. They're really funny. And so they sit down to have a meal on his recruiting visit. And they're like, all right, we can't eat until you give us one Rick story. And he was like, right now? He's like, right now. We're not ordering any appetizers, no drinks, no nothing. One Rick story. So he goes, okay, the other day. They're like, whoa, you got a good one the other day? He's like, yes, the other day. So the story goes, David Jackson, you know, he's a sophomore. He's playing like 15 minutes a game, super frustrated. And he decides, all right, I want to leave. And so before Christmas break, he goes in to see Rick, and Rick's like, you know, just wait till after Christmas break and see how it goes, you know? So he comes back after Christmas break. He's like, he knocks on the door, and Rick answers the door in his hotel room in a towel. Right. So, cause the guy was always naked, right?
Yeah.
So he answers the door in his towel, and he's like, oh, go, David, come on in. I just, you know, got out of the shower, you know? So, can I get you anything? You know, I got a fridge full, whatever. He's like, no, Rick, it's okay. He's like, listen, he's like hemming and hawing. Listen, it's really hard for me. And you believed in me, you recruited me, and played me some. He looks up, and Rick is like, out. So now he's sitting there going like, all right, like, do I wait till he wakes up? Do I like nudge him? He said, I just want to ask for my release, right? It's man to man, face to face, raised from a good family, all right? And he's going. So finally, he like wakes Rick up. And oh, David, I'm so sorry. So sorry. He's like, yeah, Rick. He's like, yeah, you know, this medication I'm on, makes me fall asleep. It's like, and he like peels back, and he's like, got a big swollen ball. He's like, and look what it's doing to my ball. And David was like, Rick, I want my release. I want to transfer tomorrow. I'm out. Like, he literally never talked to him ever again because he showed him his big swollen ball because of some medications.
Oh, man, he used to wear shorts that were too small. That he would, whenever he'd sit down to practice, he'd sit down at the bottom of the basket stanchions. His nuts would be hanging out. He came and recruited me. He actually came out for a visit to Australia for 48 hours. And we played in a rural city outside of Melbourne. So I drove back with my junior coach, him, Kerry Rupp, in a car, 2-hour drive. And the same thing with the sleeping. He would be like, he was railing me about the way I played because I played shit that game. You know, Borgert, you need to do this, you need to do that. And then you just hear snoring mid-conversation. He just starts snoring. And I'm just like, I looked at my junior coach, looked at Kerry Rupp, and Kerry Rupp just gave me one of these ones like, oh, I don't know. And then, so I'm like, cool, long drive. I can kind of just look out the window and chill out for a bit. And then 15 minutes later, he'd wake up and continue the conversation from where he left it. So I was just like, man, this dude, like, there were red flags there already. Like, I should have seen the red flags. But I was like, this dude is crazy. Then he, like, came to my team dinner with my mum and my dad, was just saying reckless shit at the dinner table. My dad's, like, about to kill the dude. My dad's like, oh, I got to keep it calm for my son. It's a great opportunity. Like, you know, one of those ones. He farted at the table. Like, it was just, dude, like.
Wait, he farted at the table?
Yeah, like he was reckless. He didn't care, man. He did not care. And I had a friend of mine who was a teammate of mine was from Compton, California.
Who's that?
I think it was Richard Cheney. Richard Cheney, I think it was. Yeah. From that area, anyway. And he said that during the recruiting visit, you know, he was, you know, they put on a big feast, African American family, you know, and Rick ate and then just went and fell asleep on their couch during the recruiting visit with the parents. You're just like, what are you doing, man? So they're just like sitting around looking at each other like, what do we do? He's in LA.
Right, same thing. Yeah.
Asleep on the couch. Just like, no fucks given. Wakes up. All right, thanks for dinner. And just leaves. Just like a crazy dude, man. But there's the beauty of people that have played for Rick Majerus, exactly what you just hit on, is when we catch up, it just these stories go on for hours. And it's just so funny because, you know, like I play with Kevin Lish, who played at University of St. Louis. So he's out here. He's a naturalized Aussie now, but American. And he played for Majerus in St. Louis. So we'd go out to eat when I played with him 2 seasons ago and just tell stories like this for hours. You just lose track of time. And it's hilarious.
So did it – so here's what I always tell. So my coach was a hard ass, Coach Sutton. And they were – brutal to us, but I felt like it was like they would create this them against us intentionally, and it made us closer together. Like we were,
yeah,
like to this day we're super close all the guys I play, there's like one dude who's out there we don't like associate with, but everybody else we're like super close with. Did it do that where it made you guys, because you all hated him, it made you somehow, it was like a genius coaching technique to it.
Yeah. I don't think that was strategic by him. But yeah, it did. And I think that, yeah, you're definitely right. Whenever you have a hard ass coach, I think it does bring the playing group together. Even somewhat the assistants are probably even closer to the players than they should be, because they know they have to like give a few more hugs and you know, try to keep guys' chins up because it's just so hard at times. But yeah, you definitely make a valid point. I think any hard-ass coach, the players, if the players aren't together, well, at least you see it in professional sports a lot, that coach doesn't last very long.
All right, so Ray Giacoletti gets a job. What was that like?
It was interesting because at the time, I really wanted Kerry Rupp to get the job. He was the head assistant. He took over when Rick left my freshman year halfway through the year and did a pretty good job, and we all loved him. And then it kind of hurt when he didn't get it, to be honest, because we didn't know much about Ray, and he came from a smaller school, and guys were kind of like, what the hell? And then he came in with a lot of, you know, kind of methodical type offense, a lot of back cuts, Princeton type stuff, and a lot of guys kind of struggled to, you know, I guess buy into that. But then once they realized he was a good person, it was polar opposite of kind of what they've dealt with Rick, that, you know, he wasn't going to drop the C-bomb. He wasn't going to cuss you out all session. He'd fire up when he needed to. And for me, it was a godsend. You know, we got into it early. We had a few run-ins early in his tenure. And once we ironed those out, it was never looking back. And he basically gave me the keys to the team and said, you're our guy. We're going as far as you take us. And it was a really good year for us.
No, you had a great year. Okay, so the year gets done. What's the decision like in terms of pros coming back, et cetera?
Well, the more my sophomore year went on, I went from late first round pick to before my sophomore year. That's where I was projected. I had a really good Olympics in 2004, playing against the Dream Team in the US and other countries and grown men, essentially. So I was late first, and then I was mid, and then by the end of the season, it was like, this guy's a top five pick. So I wasn't really ready to go to the NBA, to be honest with you, body-wise. Like, I was still 225 that time, pounds, back in an era where there was Shaq, Yao, Dwight Howard. You needed to be 250, 260 to even compete. I wasn't grown into my body yet. I couldn't put on weight for shit, no matter what I did. I ate burgers and pizza and fries, like whatever I could do, couldn't put on weight. It just took me a while to grow into my body. So I knew I wasn't ready physically, but I'd be an idiot to pass up a chance to go top five, come back for another year, get hurt, something happens. I was also advised, the longer you stay in college, you might get nitpicked even more by scouts. They might start nitpicking little things in your game. So timing-wise, I had to go. And Ray was awesome about it. The school was awesome. And he was like, I'm not letting you come back, even if you want to come back. You need to go to the NBA. You're ready. You're kind of too good for college. We don't really have anyone that's going to make you get better. You're going to be the top of the totem pole. So you need to go get your ass kicked for a couple of years to get better. And that was kind of the decision made.
You mentioned the 2004 Olympics. What's if you close your eyes and you think of the defining things that you remember about representing your country, which is incredible, and playing at that level of basketball, what do you remember?
Just the confidence it gave me coming back for my sophomore year, because I played against grown men and held my own. Had some really good games there. And it just made me finally realize I can play not only against grown men, but at an NBA level. So then when I got back to college, I felt like I was playing with boys again. I felt like I wouldn't say I was arrogantly above them, but I just felt like I was a man amongst boys. And I treated it that way just to kick everyone's ass week in, week out. Cause I felt like, hey, I was giving it to Tim Duncan. I was holding my own against Tim Duncan, one of the best bigs of all time. And I was 19 years old. So that gave me a huge confidence boost going into my sophomore year in college.
What about the fact that you had gone from, you know, an emergency guy and not making those teams to being on the Olympic? Like that had to be pretty incredible.
Yeah, in 2 years, essentially. That was a crazy thing. Like, I went from being a relative nobody in the basketball world and then from, you know, in a space of 2.5 to 3 years, the number one pick. Like, it was – it just came together so quickly for me. And I guess an athlete's mentality is next thing, next thing, next thing. And that was my mentality. It was like, whose ass can I kick next? Where am I going? Who, where can I go where I get my ass kicked a little bit? I can get better. And that was kind of always what I had in my mind as a young fella. And I wasn't one of those kids that was a prodigy from 11, 12, 13, that you just knew that kid, LeBron James, Zion Williamson, he was going to be an NBA player. It was like, where the hell did this kid come from? Like, why don't we know about him? Number one pick, you know? And I'm pretty proud of that.
Yeah, I don't know if you remember, we actually hung out at a bar, some random bar, super late at night, draft night. You guys had, everybody had bogeyman hats on. Yeah. And it was a late, late, long night. To go from that to the number one pick in the NBA, did you know that the Bucks were taking you number one?
No, they wouldn't tell me. So they wanted to keep the element of surprise. So we kind of asked, we were grilling them. The agent was a little bit, but they wouldn't show us their hand.
What's that like?
It was amazing. Go through that whole process.
Does it feel like it was 16 years ago? 16 years ago.
It feels like a long time ago. But when you're in the midst of your NBA career, that goes quick. But, yeah, just that draft process, having my family there. And like I said, just the journey that I had to take from a young fella to go the biggest stage and go number one. Like, for me, playing like NBL basketball, playing professionally in Australia, if you would have told me at 12, 13, like someone's going to pay you and give you money to play basketball, yeah, done. Where do I sign? I never thought the NBA was – it was a fantasy. It was like – it was that fantasy TV show that you just knew, like, I'm never going to get there, but it'd be nice to get there. And then I got there and it was like, wow, like I'm actually here.
Okay, so you get there. When you got there, your first Bucks team was a weird mix, right? You had like TJ Ford was young point guard. Right, yep. But then you had some old guys. You had like Tony Kukoc on your team as well.
Yeah.
How were the old guys to you?
They also had Irvin Johnson. So they basically brought Irvin Johnson back for a season, basically to mentor me. And he was awesome to me. Like he was basically, his role was like take care of Bogues. So he'd sit on the bus near me when we go on road trips and give me the scouting report going into the arenas. Even after we land, get to Minnesota. Hey, Olu Candy does this. Garnett's going to do this. You know, like, so he was a really good mentor for me. Tony Kukoc was an idol of mine as a kid. So it was kind of surreal to be, my rookie year was his last year. But Tony was kind of burnt out at that point. He was kind of an angry veteran where he'd been through all the bullshit of the NBA and was kind of like on a knife's edge to just snapping every day. But he was good fun though. I mean, as long as Tony got his 18 holes of golf in, he was good. So then we had Michael Redd, obviously Desmond Mason was there. So the roster was kind of all over the place, trying to piece it together, but it was an interesting transition for me.
Was there a moment like a welcome to the NBA? Like, I think your first game was against Chris Webber, right? Like your first NBA game was Allen Iverson.
Yeah,
I'm looking
Philly.
At Allen yep. Iverson, Chris and Chris Webber, by the way, they had Andre Iguodala, Kyle Korver, Chris Webber, Allen Iverson in their starting lineup. Do you remember that game at all?
Yeah, I do. I do. I remember we stole that game at the end. I don't think we, you know, we were pretty close the whole game and then won that one. And then I think we went up to New Jersey and won another close one. But yeah, I mean, it was just surreal. I mean, I was a big Sacramento Kings fan today when they had, you know, that beautiful ball movement back in the early 2000s and they were, you know, they were up there with almost beating the Lakers. So I knew, you know, C. Webb, I watched a lot of his games and it was kind of surreal just to be out there and competing with those guys and actually having a good game to open up my rookie campaign.
You know, it's interesting. Here's how I felt like when I played in Europe, when I've seen Aussies play, is that I think there's a respect for American basketball. Like, look, we respect how good those dudes are, but you don't, not you personally, but they don't love how Americans play, right? In that I always feel like the Aussies feel like they're a little bit tougher. They're more about team. And, you know, it's definitely five playing as one, whereas kind of the American, especially the NBA basketball, it's end of shot clock. Hey, I'm just better than you. I'm going to jump up and make a shot. And so there's like a respect, but maybe not. Is that accurate or am I just sensing that especially like, I don't think the Spaniards, the Lithuanians, the Italians, like I don't think they like American style basketball, especially the NBA and maybe the persona of it. As an Australian who's played there, played for the national team and played in the NBA, is that a fair sense of how our game or the NBA style of game is viewed?
Yeah, to an extent. Look, we, as a national team, just speaking for Australia, we know we're not going to out-talent the US. Like, just not going to happen. Most countries aren't going to out-talent them. So we have to rely on being together, having a good culture, moving the ball, playing the right way, setting good screens, all those small things that we generally know the US team won't do. Because at the end of the day, like you said, the US can just throw it to Kevin Durant or Steph Curry and be like, get us a bucket. You know, we don't have that luxury. We have to be clinical with our execution. We have to box out. We have to get rebounds. We can't turn the ball over. So, yeah, there is an argument to that, but that's why the US is so hard to beat. They can have a horrible game and still beat you just based on talent. But as far as basketball purity, you obviously, for me personally, I like to watch the teams that move the ball and where everyone's involved. I'm not a huge fan of isolation basketball from a viewing perspective. I like to see, you know, sneaky sets, you know, hitters, good ball movement, you know, that kind of stuff. It is nice to see a guy like, you know, when Klay Thompson dropped 35, that just gets hot. That's great. Fantastic. But as far as just some guy dribbling 15, 20 times to get a shot up, I don't enjoy watching that. Some people do. I don't.
No, I don't either. It's like I say this about James Harden all the time. He's a great basketball player. And I think he's better fantastic, with Brooklyn. Yeah. Fantastic basketball player. I can't stand to watch him play. And I'm in no way indicting his talent. It's the way in which his talent was used, especially in Houston.
Oh, no doubt. And I totally agree. It's just not – and that's the way the game's gone. It's become an ISO game, and it's become, you know, shoot, if we shoot more threes than you, we're probably going to have a better chance of winning. And at times it's hard to watch, and that's might be the old man in me now. I'm that old cynical former athlete that now is – you know, it's not a case of shitting on the younger generation. I think each generation gets better than the previous one. But it's just the way the game is now, it's just not as fun to watch.
Okay, so you were in Milwaukee for like 7 years, right? Did you know that they were thinking about moving?
No, so they I asked to be moved. So 2000, and I'd gone through that injury run, kind of just got out of it. Walkout year, 2011-12, I come back. I asked, you know, the thing with Milwaukee was we were a revolving door for so many years. Like every year I'd come back and we'd have 8 or 9 or 10 new faces, new players. And I'm like, how are we going to build something? How are we going to build a culture? How are we going to build continuity? Like when you have that many new faces, it's just not going to work. We need to, you know, we're a small market team. We can't just go and sign free agents, you know, and make trades and try to hit home runs. And they kept trying to do that. And I went in and just said, look, I think, you know, I've played out what I can here. I think it's time to move on for both of us. And they said, no, we're not moving you. We're not going to get cool value back for a good center in the NBA. You know, you're still very valuable to us. And I think that was, you know, I led the league in blocks the season before. I was really coming to my own defensively and they just said no. And then 2 weeks later, Kyle Lowry shoots a floater, tries to chase his own floater down, undercuts me. I break my ankle and was then out for the rest of the season. GM was in the hot seat at the time. Coach was in the hot seat at the time. They had to make a playoff push. And they thought, well, shit, Bogues isn't going to play for the rest of the season. If we can get some value back, we'll move him. And I got traded for Monte Ellis, who then helped them get their 8th seed in the playoffs. And I went to Golden State.
Okay, so that's the end of part one of Andrew Bogut, which, of course, makes you have to listen to part two, which has Warrior stuff, Warriors-Cavs stuff, what happened in that series when they're up 3-1, what it was like to have to watch when they lost in the NBA Finals. How do you balance that out with coming back from 3-1 down to Oklahoma City in the exact same year? What it was like to leave Golden State? What it was like to watch them win a title without him? What does he think of Kevin Durant? What does he think of Steph Curry? What does he think of all of these guys? What was the difference between Mark Jackson and Steve Kerr? All of this to come in part two. In the meantime, remember, you can listen to the Doug Gottlieb Show, 3-6 Eastern, 12-3 Pacific, every day on Fox Sports Radio, the iHeartRadio app, foxsportsradio.com, or you can download that podcast whenever you want. Thank you so much for listening. Remember, subscribe, download, subscribe, rate, and write a review for All Ball.